Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we will be chatting with Charlie Miller all about the security of autonomous vehicles. As you'll hear, he says autonomous vehicle security all comes down to some security fundamentals that are in fact being taken seriously by car makers. So that's some happy news. We've got an absolutely fantastic sponsor interview for you this week. This week's show is brought to you by Senrio. They make an IoT network monitoring solution that's actually really, really quite good. And Stephen Ridley is the founder and head honcho over there at Senrio. He's a very well-known researcher, and he joins us this week to talk about a few things. First up, he recaps the GSOAP library bugs he found. They were a big deal back in July, but as you'll hear, Stephen thinks people kind of missed the point. The affected GSOAP library is absolutely everywhere, including in browsers. So yeah, there's that. So that's interesting stuff. Then in that interview, we move on to the more sponsory part, talking about Senrio's experience running the IoT Hacking Village at DEF CON. That was a great time for them, installing their product on the most hostile IoT network the world has ever seen. And to round out the Stephen Ridley Omnibus experience, we'll also hear about a few training courses he's offering on Android hacking and software exploitation via hardware exploitation. That's the Stephen Ridley Omnibus experience, and that is coming up later. But before all of that, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we begin this week's news with the tale of two websites. First up, DreamHost, which is a large hosting company in the United States, has been served with a search warrant that they're refusing to comply with for what looks like very reasonable reasons.
Yeah, this is the site DisruptJ20.org, which was involved with organizing protests during Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th and has since kind of turned into a place where there's a bunch of information about, you know, general sort of protesting and civil disobedience and, you know, expressing your political opinions in a manner which is entirely legal and fine. Anyway, yeah, they have been asked by the U.S. Department of Justice to hand over all of the weblogs for the site so they can tell who's been visiting and all that kind of thing, which, yeah, doesn't seem entirely great.
No, it does not seem particularly great. That is an understatement. You know, the company, meanwhile, is actually fighting this one. EFF are on board as well. They say they have complied with search warrants in the past, but this one is just too broad. And, you know, on the surface of it, it certainly looks to be too broad, you know. There's no question, is there?
Well, no, exactly. I mean, these warrants are meant to be for particular, you know, pieces of information or particular people or particular things, not just, you know, a wholesale list of everybody who's visited the website, when clearly, you know, the bulk of people who are visiting the site are not going to have committed any crime or done anything else. So it does seem to not meet the sorts of specificity you'd expect from a warrant. I'm not a legal expert, of course, but, you know, they are going to fight it. They will have actual experts who will say, I am sure, the same thing.
Yeah, I would guess so. Now, look, you know, it is a tale of two websites. And the other website that we're going to be speaking about today is the Daily Stormer. This is a neo-Nazi website which runs all sorts of, you know, quite objectionable stories, as is their right, I guess. But GoDaddy has cancelled their domain registration, which was pretty cool. Like, they gave them 24 hours to find another one. They re-registered it with Google. That lasted about 2 hours. And now they've announced plans to relaunch the website on the dark web. So they're being cast down into the seedy underbelly of the internet with the pedophiles and drug dealers, where they belong.
Well, exactly right. Yeah. There was also some talk that some Anons had managed to, like, post an article on the site or something.
That was a troll. It was not real. It was a way to get more clicks. You know what I mean? Like, that's why we didn't load that one up there. But
Consider me trolled then. But yeah, no, they are gone off the mainstream web. And of course, you know, pushing them underground with Tor has the downside of, you know, making them less visible. But on the other hand, it does mean that the sort of people who can go there, of course, are greatly reduced. I mean, it requires a degree of technical competence to operate Tor browser bundle. And then, of course, you're running ancient Firefox, it'll get your own. So that's probably also a net benefit for society as a whole. But also just picking up wholesale a site that was designed to run on the open internet and running it behind Tor does not, you know, a secure site make, as we've seen with all of the other things. So yeah, they'll get owned.
I don't think this is a security measure. This is really a no one will register our domain because we're a bunch of Nazi assholes. Do you know what I mean? So that's just one way to deal with the A in the CIA triad.
No, I mean, I guess I meant in more in terms of the fact that people will find where the Origin server, like where it's actually being hosted, because they won't be prepared for running it in, you know, as an onion without actually leaking where they really are. So, you know, I think they'll get taken out regardless of Tor from an availability perspective anyway.
I may have seen a couple of tweets to the effect of, gee, I wonder how long before these guys get decloaked, because there's not a lot of love for them at the moment. I think Andrew Orenheimer is actually involved in the running of that site. So they sadly do have some access to some technical expertise.
Boo.
Meanwhile, as predicted, Marcus Hutchins, a.k.a. Malware Tech, has pleaded not guilty in the US courts to charges that he created the Kronos malware.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, not a surprise. It did seem like it was going to go that way. And, yeah, we'll have to wait and see now what they've got against him. And, I mean, even – I think there was a statement from the U.S. attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Chemla, who described the alleged crimes as historic anyway, which maybe is kind of starting to walk things back a little bit. But yeah, we'll have to see where it goes for Marcus. He's going to be staying apparently in Los Angeles. He's now allowed back on the internet and has been mildly trolling on Twitter, which, you know, I guess, especially if he is in fact innocent as he's pleading, then, you know, I guess there's no harm in that. But yeah, I don't know that I want to troll the FBI whilst I'm under indictment.
Speaking of trolls, and this is a good one, this is Gizmodo really gets the Dumb Article of the Week award for this story on Carbon Black, right? Now, some people may have caught it. It started getting passed around. And what's really funny is seeing shit like this passed around by people who actually work in the security industry, you know, and you're just like, how do you have a job in this industry if you're actually taking this seriously? So basically there's a hit piece out there. A company called Direct Defense put out this, you know, I suppose it's not a hit piece, it's hit research, saying that Carbon Black's entire business model hinges on exfilling all of their clients' documents into the cloud to, you know, to then be sold to people with subscriptions to a specialist service. And really all they're talking about, like honestly what they're talking about, is in a non-default configuration of Carbon Black, you can actually tick a box that sends documents to VirusTotal. Do you know what I mean? Like that's there, which plenty of security software packages do. I mean, we wouldn't necessarily recommend it because of this problem, but to suggest that this is somehow nefarious on the behalf of Carbon Black when it's not even a default, you know, not even turned on by default, and then to suggest that they're somehow making money out of these subscriptions. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. The president of Direct Defense says, and I quote, that Carbon Black was the world's largest pay-for-play data exfiltration botnet.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, I mean, the suggestion is you would buy a subscription to VirusTotal where you get access through things that have been uploaded to it and then, you know, mine that for stuff, which, I mean, lots of people do, and it's a really useful resource. In fact, I'm sure it's the reason why Google bought VirusTotal, because it is such a gold mine of interesting sort of intelligence about what's going on around the place. But to kind of suggest that, I don't know what they're trying to suggest. Like, it's just dumb.
Yeah, they're trying to suggest that there's a financial motivator behind them exfilling, you know, so-called exfilling data to VirusTotal. It is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Now, people are throwing a bit of shade at Silence over this because the company that did the research is a partner company of Silence. Silence are a client of Risky Business. I'd be pretty surprised knowing the people, pretty senior people in that company, if they thought this was a good idea. So I think we can kind of knock that on its head. I would be surprised. I mean, of course, it's not impossible, but I would be surprised. Brian Krebs actually has a decent write-up on all of this.
Yeah, no, Krebs kind of pulls it apart and makes it into the, you know, fairly rubbish story that it is. But yeah, it's... I don't know. There's loads of interesting stuff in VirusTotal. Like that bit is absolutely not under debate, and you can find lots of fun things. But yeah, the idea that it's, you know, a thing that they would do on purpose. And I mean, Carbon Black came out and said, you know, it's a non-default configuration. We specifically advise our customers of the privacy implications. You can filter exactly what sorts of things get set. Like it's just not at all credible. I think we can all just have a laugh at Direct Defense about it.
Motherboard reports that apparently the shadow brokers have made nearly 90K selling, you know, the NSA's goodies. I thought it was pretty difficult to actually track Monero transactions. So how have they worked this out?
That's actually a good question. I'm not sure, I'm not familiar with the innards of Monero, but apparently one of the things that they instruct to people who are paying by Monero to do to get their, you know, subscribed to, you know, wine of the month club exploits was stick their email address in one of the metadata fields of the transaction, and someone's figured out how to decode those and has gone and emailed the people who've been buying it, and at least one of them is now upset on Twitter saying that he got like one rubbish exploit for his money and was not particularly happy with the quality of service, so I'm sure he'll return it for a full refund. But yeah, $90,000, I guess, you know, given how good Eternal Blue was, doesn't seem like a whole bunch of money, unless in fact they have in fact mined out the entire stash and are now just cashing in.
Well, it's better than what they get paid by the government, right, in Russia. So,
you know, ooh, snap.
That'll be a nice Christmas bonus, I'm guessing, in the end, you know. HBO, apparently, an email purportedly written by HBO, and it does have the ring of authenticity about it, I have to say, just on a gut feel. I mean, we can't prove that it's HBO, but it just feels like maybe it is. They apparently offered $250,000 to as a so-called bug bounty to a bunch of people who owned them pretty hard. You know, they stole scripts for things like Game of Thrones and whatever. So yeah, HBO has apparently offered them $250,000 as a sign of good faith. Although a lot of people are reporting that this could in fact just be a stalling tactic while they figure out what the hell to do.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say. Like, it could be smart like a fox stalling tactics because they've asked for, what, $6 million at the moment. And, yeah, maybe a dangling of $250K in front of them might be enough to kind of keep them under wraps long enough for them to figure out what's going on. But, yeah, it might also actually be, you know, them attempting to buy their way out of the problem that they're in, which, yeah, it is kind of hard to say. We'll have to see whether or not anyone shows up with, you know, a new Ferrari or something. But, yeah, they're in a difficult place.
Well, I've often compared these sort of ransom situations to being very similar to, you know, when Somali pirates might take over a ship, you know, and they ransom it back and they might start it. Hey, we want $20 million, and you might get them down to two. Do you know what I mean? But it's a long process and there's a lot of to and fro. So I'm guessing, you know, if there are any piracy investigators, like actual high seas, piracy investigators listening, you know, this could be a new industry for you, handling these sorts of negotiations. Interesting story from Lorenzo over at Motherboard. Apparently APT28 or Fancy Bear has been owning a whole bunch of hotels. And, you know, I guess I'd ask you, Adam, why?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the historical reason to own hotels, of course, is to steal all the card data that's lying around everywhere. But we have seen attacks in the past where people are doing that to get access to the details about who's staying in a hotel, like owning high-profile, you know, hotel chains used by high-profile guests, which is what's being targeted here. And also to gain access to, you know, the infrastructure of the hotel, be it, you know, the doors or be it the wireless networks. We've seen people having their accounts compromised after they've used the wireless networks at hotels. So it's a great place to find, you know, both information about travelers and to then leverage that for access into the rest of their infrastructure. So yeah, it's a pretty natural place for someone like Fancy Bear to show up, I think. And yeah, just a reminder to everybody to, you know, be careful while you're traveling. I mean, that whole evil made attack scenario is not without its, you know, basis in reality.
Staying with stuff that is likely state sponsored, I actually saw this floating around I think before last week's show, but I didn't get a chance to dive into it, but it does look interesting. This Netsarang server management software has experienced they're a South Korean company, and they appear to have experienced a bit of a supply chain attack that looks, you know, proper interesting.
Yeah, so it looks like someone owned them and then backdoored one of the DLLs in their updates, which was then pushed out to their customers. And because the thing is used for server management, obviously you can then use that to get access to the machines being managed. And yeah, this kind of supply chain stuff, like we've seen this, I mean, specifically for server management, we've seen a couple of, you know, sort of quite niche but widely deployed, you know, system admin monitoring tools getting compromised in this manner. We talked about there was a log management one a while back. We talked about, was it Ultra Edit got owned as well? Like, I mean, these are pieces of software that sysadmins use in all sorts of interesting places. And yeah, this was picked up, and now they've, you know, rolled out some updates that don't have backdoors in them. So that's nice to see. But it was quite a sophisticated piece of malware as well in terms of how it was initially triggered via, you know, the DNS trigger that had some, you know, encryption of what it was doing and multi-stage loaders. So you couldn't tell what was going on until you got the subsequent stages delivered. So yeah, quite a, you know, operationally sophisticated as well as technically sophisticated thing being dropped. So yeah, interesting, eh?
Well, it is, right? And because, you know, we always used to focus on stuff like, you know, browser OD and whatever. And, you know, if you want to know how people are getting owned by sophisticated crews these days, this is how they're doing it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this supply chain stuff and figuring out who's upstream of your target, like this, it's the way to go for modern attackers, you know, rather than, as you say, like browser ODAs for competitions and showing off.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, I mean, just speaking to a bunch of my friends, like you included, that, you know, owning enterprise software was a great way to move laterally. But if you can infiltrate the supply chain, you can kind of pop your initial shell via, you know, by infiltrating the supply chain of all of this sort of stuff. And we're not just talking about server management stuff and, you know, because hardware vendors typically write truly, you know, management vendors typically write the worst stuff. But enterprise software isn't like too far behind it. So I'm wondering I'm wondering when we're going to see some supply chain attacks affecting very commonly used enterprise software. I'm thinking stuff like Oracle, CA, IBM, right? Like that has to be coming. That's there you go. I'm making a prediction, which in this industry is always a risky thing to do. But there you go. More Chrome extensions have been compromised, Adam. This has turned into a real thing.
Yeah, there was a report that came out this week which talks about, I think, another seven or a total of seven Chrome extensions that have been compromised in the similar sort of manner to the Copyfish one we talked about last week. The big one perhaps is the web developer plugin for Chrome, which quite a few people use. But yeah, there's a bunch of others as well. So yeah, this is a good example of exactly that supply chain attack going on. And, you know, Google's going to have to get a good handle on it pretty quick.
Yeah. Blizzard Entertainment has been smashed with a pretty severe DDoS. I don't think we really need to spend much time on that. But our thoughts are with you. a more interesting outage has occurred in Venezuela. An Agence France-Presse piece about this has been picked up by a few outlets, but it's a little bit thin on detail. But apparently several million people in Venezuela wound up without phone service due to some sort of, you know, targeted denial of service attack against the telcos.
Yeah, apparently a group called the Binary Guardians, which does sound like the sort of thing that North Korea would come up with, have claimed responsibility for an attack which targeted websites, government, Supreme Court, and National Assembly, but that there is a separate denial of service, maybe the same group, maybe not, against MobileNet, one of their GSM telcos, where 7 of their 13 million users are currently without service. But there's also been physical attacks on fiber infrastructure around the country. So, strong combination of cyber and, you know, I guess cutting fiber is kinetic. Or maybe that's still cyber. I'm not down with terminology so much. But either way, it sounds pretty bad if you're in Venezuela at the moment.
Well, things are pretty bad there all around, you know. I mean, that's one I've been following pretty closely over the last couple of years. And, sorry to go off topic here, everyone, but, you know, during my travels in Brazil last year, you know, I met a bunch of Venezuelans who were, you know, in essence, they were refugees from their own country. And that was a while ago and things have got worse. So I'd expect to see more action on the Venezuelan cybers as time continues. IoT fail of the week, Lockstate, this manufacturing of smart locks managed to brick their locks and put them in a state where they couldn't be unlocked. So that's great.
Yeah, really. I mean, I don't know what you expected connecting your locks to the internet, but yeah, apparently they pushed out a firmware update that was intended for a later model of lock and it bricked the earlier model and they locked something like, well, they say more than 500 customers. So anywhere from 500 to, you know, all of their customers, I guess, had their locks put into a state where you couldn't actually unlock them without the key. And given the whole point of these locks was to either A, unlock them remotely, and B, they have pin pads so people can get into them without the keys. Apparently they are provided, or there is a deal with Airbnb where people can use them for their Airbnb rentals, which, you know, I guess is a sensible thing to do. You can change the code regularly. You don't have to give people the keys. Seems smart. But yes, connecting them to the internet whilst you do all those things, clearly not so smart.
Yeah, well, Airbnb guests, apparently, I mean, the thinking is that they've actually been stranded, unable to get into their bookings because of this. So that's pretty bad. And apparently this thing won't now connect back, so they can't auto fix it. So what the hell are they going to do?
Well, apparently, yeah, you have to either pull the actual controller board off, send it back to get the firmware reloaded, or you have to put a new lock in. You're screwed, basically.
Nice work, Lockstate. Well done. So, yeah, good IoT horror story for the slide deck there. In the least surprising news to cross my desk this week, apparently Stingray detection apps, you know, IMSI Catcher detection apps in the Android Play Store, not very effective. I'm shocked, Adam. I'm shocked.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously the people who are writing these apps are doing so without access to actual test stingrays, which makes sense. I mean, these things are
well, and without access to the actual, you know, hardware interfaces that you need access to make a determination as to whether or not you're being stingrayed,
well,
right?
So. Exactly right. And you end up guessing from kind of heuristics and assuming how you think the stingray might work and then just sort of YOLOing your way to something that people are then going to rely on for more than what it's good for. So, yeah, no surprises in this story at all.
A Ukrainian man has been arrested and charged in for distributing not Petya, but we shouldn't get too excited because this is not linked to the initial distribution of the virus. Apparently he made videos about it on, you know, how you can infect people with it, which, yeah, probably not a really smart idea, dude. But yeah, he's been arrested now by apparently the cyber police of Ukraine. They actually do have cyber cops.
That's pretty cool. I wonder what their hats look like. They must be pretty awesome looking hats. The thing I thought was interesting about this story, though, is right down the bottom, it says that during the police's seizure of this guy's computers, apparently they found a list of companies in Ukraine that the police are claiming used the Petya malware to purposefully sabotage their own computers to hide incriminating information that they were being compelled to hand over as part of, you know, other, you know, investigations or something. So they're actually like going Enron style, you know, shredding all their documents. But they're using Petya to do it, which that's a pretty cool plot twist.
Well,
I didn't think of that.
I got to say it, like, you got to hand it to the Grok. This is something that he predicted as an excellent way to cover tracks, right? He did. He's like, ransomware is the best cover. You go in, you do what you need to do, then you ransomware the box and call it a day, you know? Goodbye, yeah. Logs.
No, I mean, clearly Grok has good, bad ideas. So, yeah.
He does. Now, staying with something very interesting, we are actually getting to the point. It's been long enough since Black Hat that we're actually starting to get a much more accurate idea of what was interesting and what wasn't. And Dave Jorm, actually, a friend of ours, sent me a link to some research by Alvaro Munoz and Alexander Mirosh called Friday the 13th, JSON Attacks, and it's all about deserialization, and it has people who are smarter and more technical than me very, very excited. Adam, please explain it to me.
Yeah, now this is definitely for me the highlight of the Black Hat talks that I've seen so far. I haven't seen the actual talk, I haven't seen the slide deck, but yeah, I mean, obviously Dave Jorm, who sent it to you, has done a lot of talks about deserialization attacks in the past and does know a thing or two about them. And yeah, this is a talk about looking at the state of Java deserialization attacks and then thinking about what we've learned from that process in the last 3 or 4 years as they've become popular and applying it to JSON and XML parsers in other languages, and in particular .NET. And this is a really, really good set of research on what the kind of exploitation primitives are for exploiting deserialization of .NET objects that are stored in JSON or in XML, and quite a thorough examination of the various libraries that implement that kind of deserialization on both Java and .NET. And yeah, it's if you are in the business of doing pen testing or hacking and you're, you know, all do .NET or Java code review, this is absolutely a slide deck that you should read. They have a great great write-up of some of the primitives, a great write-up of some of the ways that you can kind of get into the right place to use them, things to look for. Yeah, it's a great piece of research.
It's great to see a slide deck from Black Hat in 2017 that is actually talking about how to own stuff.
Well, yeah, exactly. No, it is. It's refreshing, right? It's not all Internet of Things rubbish or stunt hacking. This is like proper, honest to God, you know, top class hacking. Good stuff.
That's it. Staying with interesting research, there's a Usenix paper floating about which looks at a file system attack vector for Rowhammer-like attacks. That's the name they've given it, but it's like it's taking random block corruption to Privesk. And everyone's sort of excited about this one as well. Have you had a chance to read it?
So I read the abstract in the first little bit. It's quite a detailed paper, but essentially the thing here is that they are taking the thinking of Rowhammer, which is using non-physical means to attack physical properties of computer systems, and instead of applying it to RAM, applying it to MLC NAND flash, so the storage cells in your SSD disk that use multi-level NAND memory cells, as by controlling the contents that gets written to adjacent cells on the flash to be able to cause them to corrupt in predictable ways, which then interact with the controller of the, you know, of the SSD, and then the operating system's file system cache, and then onwards to the privilege model of the operating system, which is quite a detailed attack, and in many respects kind of more complicated than the RAM Rowhammer case.
I just love these. I mean, because they all start out theoretical, but as we've seen, Rowhammer has very much slid over the last couple of years into the practical realm. But I just love these, like, at this stage, completely needlessly complicated ways of owning people. Do you know what I mean? They're really great.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing about Rowhammer and this, you know, this, well, I guess Rowhammer is now a class of attacks rather than just the RAM one, like RAM and disk Rowhammering. The thing about these is it provides a way to jump around virtualization, because this is an area that we haven't thought about virtualizing, because we're passing through to the underlying operating system to the underlying storage. I mean, that maybe there are ways to do it, and that's why this is super interesting, why Rowhammer was interesting as well. So yeah, no, this is definitely a piece of research to keep an eye on, and I'm sure they will develop it further, because yeah, it has some, you know, some potentially big implications if it turns out to be as effective as the memory Rowhammer.
All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. I've got another couple of links in this week's show notes as well, including a story from Joseph Cox at Motherboard about, you know, legal hacking tools that journalists can use, which is really just about footprinting and stuff and you know, technical research tools. That's a good read if you are a journalist and you want to sort of tool up a little bit. And also congratulations to Joseph. He's just taken a new job with the Daily Beast. So we will be reading his stuff there from now on. But yes, as I said, that is it for the week's news. Adam, thank you very much. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a discussion of the security news of the last week. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Charlie Miller, the new and improved buff Charlie Miller, it has to be said. He is looking terrific, and I always like to see hackers looking after themselves. It is a little bit too uncommon, I have to say. Charlie has been around in InfoSec for a long time. He did some time at NSA, did some independent research of note for many years, but he became much more widely known after he and his pal Chris Valasek owned a Jeep remotely over at Cellular Connection and freaked out Andy Greenberg from Wired in a somewhat legendary video. You know, cutting the engine remotely while Andy was driving along was really pretty awesome stunt hacking, you know, top notch. Since then, Miller and Valasek have both specialized in vehicle security. Miller did a stint at Uber before leaving for a rival company, Didi. He was there only for about 4 months, but he's actually left that job and has got the band back together. Valasek did remain behind at Uber for some time, but now they've both left their jobs and they're working for GM's autonomous division, Cruise. You'll notice in this interview that we're both speaking uncharacteristically quietly, and that's actually because we were in the media working room at Black Hat. Anyway, here is Charlie Miller on autonomous vehicle security. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, it's funny that the attacks and the defense for autonomous cars isn't really that different from attacking or defending just a network of computers. The biggest difference is that if you do get in, instead of stealing emails or something, you get to like kill somebody. So it's a little more, you know, on the line.
A little more high impact, right? So that's really what you'd call a critical.
Yeah, I suppose that's a 10 CV score. No, but for real, like it's the same kind of stuff. So like reduce attack surface and you know, verify the code that's running and you know, minimize bugs and segregate things out and just the same sort of security in depth and things you would do for a corporate network, you do for a car network. The other difference is that you have a lot more control, so you don't have random people on your network clicking links and stuff. So in some ways, it's kind of easier because it's just computers talking to computers in very predictable ways, and it's easier to find anomalies in that.
Now, you say that you don't have people clicking links and whatever, but these things are getting more and more connected and handling more and more stuff. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, there's a whole bunch of cars that have, you know, your Spotify and your Pandora and your this and your that, and there's going to be bugs there. The stuff you exploited on Jeep, I mean, that really relied on owning the head unit and then pivoting from there. And I really hope when I look at these companies pushing out these autonomous vehicles that they've kind of made that less likely to happen.
I don't know. So, I mean, you have to have things connected. If you're a ride-sharing car, you have to know where to go pick someone up and where to drop them off. And so it's going to be connected to the internet. And then that, again, that computer needs to tell the steering and the engine, like, oh, okay, I want to go to point A. And the way you do that is you drive a little bit and you turn right. And so,
But do we want to be doing this on the same processor that is playing your Spotify playlist?
No, for sure. I mean, that's where it comes in. So like I said, like some stuff is connected and the things that are, you know, don't need to be connected to the other things, you disconnect them. And so it's not rocket science, but it's just a matter of analyzing very closely what components are in the car and which need to be connected, which don't. And I don't know. I mean, it's again, it's not that hard to do. It just takes time and effort to do it right.
I'd imagine, though, I mean, we're seeing some very clever people getting hired and being paid very big salaries to go and work for the companies that are working on this technology. It feels to me that it is being given priority, and we're unlikely to see, you know, murder, death, kill, worms, you know, smashing traffic in a major city anytime, you know, in the foreseeable future. So I'm not too terrified of it. I mean, should I be more scared?
A lot of people are scared, and I'm not that worried about it just because I know how hard it was for us to do the Jeep. It took us, you know, 2 years of pretty hard research, and we're pretty smart guys. So it's not something just some you know, pranksters are going to do over a weekend. It's,
yeah, not the next LulzSec, right?
I don't know if they could do that, but unless they put their heads to it really hard. But yeah, so it's hard, but still, the effects are so large that it's not so hard that two guys couldn't do it on, you know, as a weekend hobby, which is what happened. So let's make it harder to wear at least that
weekend. Yeah, that sounds like reasonable advice. Now, the other aspect to all of this is the machine learning thing, right? Which I find, you know, all of the discussion around machine learning, whether we're talking about, you know, malware classification or network defense or whatever it is, I mean, it's interesting stuff. And when you see stuff like Tesla's machine learning autonomy, you know, they've got those demo videos and stuff that show it identifying objects and things like that and classifying them. It's a fascinating tech. Now, poisoning a data set is something that, you know, is seen as one way to mess with machine learning. But I'd imagine that when you're dealing with autonomous vehicles, the amount of testing and the data set that this machine learning is based on is just massive. Is that right?
Well, I don't have much to do with the actual, like, autonomy system. To me, it's a black box I have to secure. So that doesn't worry me so much, but something kind of related to what you're talking about is these attacks where someone uses some sort of special setup to try to confuse the sensors and make the car make bad decisions based on...
Well, I was going to get to that next, which is, you know, the other problem with machine learning is to enumerate it somehow so you can sort of spot the gaps and then slide stuff through. I mean, that's when you're talking about malware classification, but you might be able to find ways to confuse a vehicle. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can drive a truck with some billboard with some pattern on it across a highway and just freak it out and make it, you know, make it crash or something. I mean, is that something that's you know, considered as a threat?
I mean, researchers have shown that they can shine a laser or something and confuse LiDAR sensors or otherwise confuse the radar or something. So or jam something. And so there have been actual research done to see if this is a problem. And it is a problem, but at the same time, it's not something that scales well. Like, there's going to be a guy standing on a corner with a big-ass piece of equipment.
Well, not only that, but you've got, you know, like the LiDAR stuff. You know, we saw that fatality involving the Tesla vehicle where the, you know, the truck drove across the road and it confused the truck for the sky. If it had radar, that probably wouldn't have been an issue, right? Because radar would have picked it up. So now we're seeing autonomous vehicles coming with radar. So what we're seeing is, like, you know, more and more different types of sensors. So any sort of attack you would need to do towards one of these vehicles would have to be pretty precise and synchronized, right? I mean, I don't fancy your odds unless you've put a couple of years and, you know, 20 really smart people on it.
Yeah, so I'm not super worried about it. It's sort of the same as a human driving a car and you stand on the corner. You have a big bucket of paint you throw on their windshield, right? And they can't see the crash. So it's something I do worry about, and it's in the threat model.
There are easier ways to kill people, I think, is what you're getting at.
Right. And this the ultimate solution is to have cars with multiple redundant types of sensors. So you mentioned, like, there's LiDAR and there's radar, and there are attacks against each of those, but you're probably not going to be able to do both of those attacks simultaneously. So if you get weird data that doesn't agree from two different sensors, you can make some decision that something's happening and pull over or something.
I don't know if you caught this news, but apparently autonomous tech has a bit of a hard time in Australia for now because it's trained on data sets that don't include kangaroos. And the way kangaroos move, because they jump, they don't run, really freaks out the machine learning models because they're just like, what the hell is that? When they jump, it looks like they're moving away to the machine learning. I mean, there's going to be some confusing stuff. I mean, I know we're just going down the machine learning rabbit hole and it's not really your thing, but it's one of the more interesting parts of it. Are there other people in these organizations that do autonomous vehicles that really are, I mean, they'd have to be, right? That's like a lot of the science, isn't it, that look at those sort of problems?
Yeah, for sure. It's they're, you know, the reason that they're testing millions of miles is because the weird stuff happens very rarely.
The edge cases.
Right. And so the only way to test that is to just drive and drive and drive and drive until you've encountered every weird, you know, shopping cart driving across, you know, the road and hits a bump and who knows. Like, they have to encounter everything to test it. There's some weird story I heard about. They had done all the mapping in winter, and the cars were driving great. And then spring came, and all the bushes got leaves and stuff. And so everything looked different to the car, and the car couldn't figure out what to do.
Yeah, like snow, right? That's got to be a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, snow's a challenge, which is one of the reasons you probably, if you live somewhere where it snows a lot, you won't see an autonomous car. You won't be one of the first people to get autonomous cars, that's for sure.
So I'm guessing a lot of this comes back to, you know, what you were saying. A lot of it comes back to just security first principles, right? And building an ecosystem. I think we're going to wind up with a situation where we're going to have apps running on, you know, cars, right? That's going to make a lot of sense. I'm guessing that there's going to be a trend towards a closed ecosystem for that sort of stuff, a la Apple, and maybe even a little bit more careful. Is that sort of ecosystem consideration a high concern in your experience?
Like, for me, I've only worked for ride-sharing companies, and so the idea is these are cars that people get in for a little bit and then they get out, so we have a little more freedom. Like, it's harder to secure an autonomous car because we have all the stuff that comes in the car, plus all the stuff that we're adding that is more tech service and more control of the car. I mean, basically, though, the advantage we have is we can rip out stuff. So you're talking about, oh, it has to have an app. It's like, well, maybe I don't want to have Bluetooth. Like, I don't care if they can sync their phone, right? I'd rather just take out the Bluetooth chip. But if you're selling a car, you can't do that. And so we do have some more control over, like, stripping out stuff that we don't need. And likewise, like, one of the problems with cars in general with security is you sell a car and you don't see it again for maybe 10 years. And it's just the person driving around, can't update the software, nothing like that. But in a ride-sharing environment, you can make the car come home every night and check it out, make sure it's okay, you know, update.
You can send it away for a service if you
right.
want to. Right?
You can add new software, you can add new hardware, whatever you want. And so you have a lot more, you don't have to do over-the-air updates, for example, because I'll just have it come home and I'll do it myself. So as a company that is thinking, not trying to sell, like, 5 billion cars or something. We're just trying to make a service that allows people to hop in and out. We have some advantages from a security perspective.
Okay, but like, let's talk about the autonomous vehicle manufacturers, because that's the one that kind of concerns me, is that, you know, we've always traditionally experienced this trade-off between time to market and security, right? And my favorite example of that is, you know, Google catching up with Android. And now we've got this huge Google Android malware problem in China as a result of them really trying to get out to market and catch up with iOS, and to hell with the consequences. Does it worry you that we could see some sort of similar market race in the field of autonomous vehicles? Because it does concern me a little bit, right? Because of the way cars are marketed, it's very much about features. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
I can see a board say, no, ship it, right? And we know that that's where bad things can happen. Is that something that concerns you at all? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to gauge is how much of a concern is the security stuff at the top levels of these companies? Now, I know you work for a ride-sharing platform, right? And that's where you've been. But you're going to talk to other people in other organizations. So what's your read on that?
I mean, every industry has had a problem with getting security into their products, and I think that it's something that just has to be learned. Like, it's not something that industry is going to do.
Well, Google learning that, you know, looks like malware on Chinese phones, you know, an autonomous, you know, Chevrolet learning that looks a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, the point of the research that Chris and I did with the Jeep was that was supposed to be the learning moment for them, that now they think about security, hopefully. The one difference is that car companies have a long history of having a concern about safety, which isn't exactly the same thing, but like, they care about cars that are safe because people care about that, and that's
well, that was the Ford Pinto moment in the 70s was their big, you know, wake up, wasn't it?
Right. So that's something you can sell people on, is we have the safest car, and so people will pay for that. So they have a culture of safety. It's just sort of getting them to kind of realize that cybersecurity in their cars is also a safety issue, and once they see that, then hopefully they'll use their existing culture to kind of make sure that their cars are safe in that way as well.
And do you think they do know that already?
I hope so. I mean, I can only do so much, but and the car companies don't really tell me what they're doing, or, you know, share with the community in general what they're doing. But everyone I've talked to says that, you know, the Jeep thing kind of shook them up. And, you know, the I talk more to like the engineer level people, and they're like, oh, now all of a sudden we have budget and people listen to us. And so,
well, I mean, I can tell you too, from what I've heard, I know a few people who deal with the auto industry, and you know, the biggest growth category after your Jeep hack was these, you know, automotive cybersecurity conferences in Detroit. There was one a week. You know?
Yeah, they're all the time. I can't keep up with them. You would think I would know all the car security conferences, but there's like so many of them.
You've single-handedly spawned a new, you know, conference category. Well done.
And yet I got no money from it. It's amazing.
Oh, so there we go. Maybe we'll get a Patreon for you. Charlie Miller, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Charlie Miller there. And hey, I want to point out too that a couple of weeks back in the news, we spoke about Tesla, a Tesla, getting owned by a group of Chinese researchers who presented their findings at Black Hat. Charlie actually got in touch with me over Twitter and pointed out that the Tesla in question was running a non-default configuration. So that's definitely worth correcting. And sorry, Tesla people, we really should have mentioned that caveat. And yeah, bad us. Naughty, no biscuit. Okay, it is on to this week's sponsor interview now, the Stephen Ridley Omnibus Experience. Stephen, of course, is the founder and head honcho of Senrio. This is a company that makes a network sensor designed to identify IoT devices on networks. It's a really great bit of kit that's very easy to deploy. So whether you're in manufacturing or you're a hospital or any type of other organization that has to deal with IoT visibility and anomaly detection, you really do need to check out Senrio. There's a few companies in this space, and I can say confidently at least one of them is basically just copying what Stephen and his team have built with Senrio. But yeah, they've also recently kicked off a program for MSSPs who might want to offer IoT monitoring to their customers. This works for telcos as well, who actually sell, you know, 4G, LTE, or even 3G access to, you know, huge SCADA networks and stuff. So yeah, we're going to talk about that. We're also talking about Stephen's experience of running the IoT Hacking Village at DEF CON, and we're going to preview some training that he's currently offering as well. So do stay tuned to the end of the show for the discount code for that training, by the way. And yeah, for those of you who've been in the industry a while, you know Stephen. For those of you who don't, he's a researcher of note. He's a very well-respected guy. And yeah, I went long on this interview because he had some very interesting stuff to say about some bugs that he disclosed last month in the GSOAP libraries. We spoke about them in the news. These bugs did get a lot of attention because they affect an awful lot of IoT. But as you'll hear, those libraries do pop up everywhere, including in some browsers. And you'll hear Stephen talk about that in his oh-so-coy way. So here he is, Stephen Ridley, talking about a whole bunch of stuff. But I'll drop you in now where he's talking about those GSOAP libraries.
We found the bug in a specific device, a security camera, an enterprise-grade security camera that we were looking at. And this was one of those cameras that we'd seen everywhere. In fact, after we found the bug, I was walking through LAX, the international terminal to actually come out to Australia. And I saw like kind of every 20 feet or so was the exact same camera model, like embedded in the ceiling of the airport. So it's used in like, you know, really, really big places like that. And we had known that. So that's why we were looking at that camera. We found a really great bug there. The research team led by M. Carlton. We weaponized and everything and got everything working fairly well. And then we kind of looked a little bit closer. We had obviously through symbols and the reversing and stuff had an idea of where it was in the firmware. But then we realized that it was actually a commonly used library. We initially kind of thought it was something that that the company had developed. So it was in this this parsing library written by a company called Genevia, and GSOAP is the library. And it's in a number of not just IoT devices, but also embedded in browsers, you know, wrapped up in software of various kinds. Anything that basically needs to parse XML or HTML data.
So this is like one of those typical things where you found a bug in a bit of code that just has popped up everywhere in the sort of broader software supply chain.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, like one of the things that we kind of say, it's like a mantra now. It's pretty bad is like code reuse is vulnerability reuse. And that's obviously, you know, the security folks understand that, but it really helps us to communicate these things to manufacturers and, you know, software developers. Every time you're reusing a bit of code, sure, it's helping you speed time to market. But if you haven't audited, you're assuming the same vulnerabilities, right? You're incorporating the same vulnerabilities that might exist in that library into your product.
So how does one go about exploiting this? Because I understand you need to throw like the exploit for this thing is like 2 gig. I mean, that would sort of mitigate it a little bit, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it does. But so that was funny. Like that was one of the criticisms of it. It's definitely like, it's not like a really small payload or anything. The vulnerability basically kind of starts with a numeric overflow. So we have to kind of get a value to wrap around to you know, trigger the next stage of the exploitation. But you got to remember, like, even though it seems like a lot of data, this is a video camera that's streaming live video, right? So, like, by definition, this is a fairly high bandwidth device. It's not like a small device. And one other strong misconception we realized is people thought that because of the large amount of data that have to be sent to trigger the overflow, you know, it wouldn't make exploitation as easy because the device would need to have that much RAM. That's not true. Actually, the device that we weaponized the exploit for and did the exploit demo for only had 256 megs of RAM, right? So that actually didn't matter at all because it was taking the data from the stream, processing it. And,
yeah, anything that's got a reliable connection, you can sort of smash it. How does this translate into an issue for browsers, though? Because that's not something I've seen reported on at all.
Yeah, we actually did not look into that because, you know, as a research company who we really like to do responsible disclosure. The moment you know, you kind of have an obligation to notify people, right? Especially if you're going to eventually publish it. So we didn't really look into it too much, but we did look at some things like download statistics. If you just do searches for like GSOAP or some of the main libraries or functions that are used in the GSOAP documentation, like if you search for those, like copy a function name that looks somewhat unique to GitHub, right, or just Google. There's a bunch of different projects, and you know, it's all kinds of stuff from, you know, university projects to you know, any kind of application processing network data, basically.
But you were saying that there were specific browsers that contain this code. Are you saying that you actually haven't looked at how to trigger this in a browser, but someone maybe you should? Why be coy now, Stephen?
So here's the thing. It's it is the go-to implementation library for C and C++ for parsing XML and HTML documents. So every other major...
Enough said, right? Like, so...
right.
So I'm guessing you are suggesting that someone out there might be able to have a look at where else this thing's turned up and maybe figure out that, you know, it's, you can do stuff with it.
Yeah, take a look. It's used in a lot of places. That's for sure. So, so actually kind of back to that point, we found the vulnerability in the one camera. We reported it. The company that makes the camera called Axis Communications, came back to us and said, this looks like it's in all but 3 of our products. So the final count was 249 different products, not just, cameras, but also access control devices that they make. DVRs, recorders, all that kind of stuff. And then what Axis did is kind of, you know, we were going through the process of helping them get that stuff fixed. They said, hey, we actually found out about this product and because we were designing our products to spec from this consortium of manufacturers called Onvif. And so we were like, oh, really? So we took a look at Onvif. And if you just go to Onvif, I think, .com or .org, O-N-V-I-F, you can see all the member organizations. And it's like Siemens, Cisco, all the big networking vendors, like virtually every camera vendor you can think of, the Hikvision, and all the really obscure ones are in that list. And the idea is that consortium comes up with kind of design patterns that are for specific to certain devices. Right, so if it's going to be a DVR system, you might want to use the following operating systems and the following libraries. Right, if it's going to be an access control system, you do, this bundle of tools, and maybe you get this hardware from this manufacturer. So they, through kind of their recommendations, actually broaden the scope of the vulnerability or possibly the impact of the vulnerability, because GSOAP was one of the recommended libraries for basically kind of any kind of connected video device. So, yeah.
So I guess what you're saying is this thing is everywhere. And I'm guessing of the devices out there that use this library, you know, maybe it's more of a concern than if this pops up in a browser, because in a browser context, maybe if you need a 2 gigabyte payload, that's probably a little bit tricky. Whereas with, you know, devices that are cameras, they got, you know, reliable high speed connections, and they're probably not going to get updated and be around for a while. Yep. And this will probably affect all of them.
Yep.
So yay.
Yep. Yep. That's the crazy part. Like that whole thing, code reuse is vulnerability use. And it goes back to the whole IoT problem, right? Is that, you know, these manufacturers, even though there's a fix for this devil's IV bug, it probably won't even make it into products for, if ever, right? Because these manufacturers are trying to clone, like get clone, like copy that part of the code that they need, or maybe gets a version number gets distributed as part of the spec to this consortium like ONVIF. Now you have thousands of manufacturers using a specification with an old version number in it that doesn't contain the fix. So you're having completely brand new products hit the market with old libraries, right? And we're seeing that. Like most embedded Linux-based devices are on like 2.6 kernels, right? They don't have stack cookies. They don't use ASLR. This is like the IoT world right now. Like basic, super easy, low-cost protection mechanisms from like 2001 aren't even making it into these devices. It's really, really sad.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, right? Because like now let's move from the research bit. And I'm sure there's a few people who just listened to that who are like probably pulling up a few repos at the moment and thinking, gonna dig into this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, let's move on to the more, you know, the more sponsory part of this interview. So you sponsored the IoT Hacking Village at DEF CON. What was that like? Because I understand for you it was, you know, I mean, you did it for two reasons. First of all, there's a marketing benefit there because people with an interest in IoT security obviously are going to be floating about, and that is your business.
Yeah.
Secondly, I can imagine that it would have been quite useful network data from your point of view. If you're doing IoT network monitoring, you would have been able to sort of test your tech in the world's most hostile IoT environment.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, that's exactly kind of all the major reasons we did it. Plus, honestly, like we're spawned from the community too. So it's really cool to like have something that you think is actually useful, you know, to, you know, for events like this. So, you know, our product kind of, we explain it concisely, three pieces, VINP, VIP, right? Visibility, identification, and profiling. So visibility will tell you kind of what's happening on the network. Identification, we can tell you what's on the network. And profiling, we can tell you when a device is behaving abnormally. So those three things all happen through passive metadata analysis. So we don't do deep packet inspection. The profiling engine doesn't need to, you know, look inside of SSL connections and see what's happening. So we keep it kind of, you know, relatively private. And then the cool thing is like identification. So with just passive identification of only metadata, we can tell you this looks like a Hikvision S model phone. It's running embedded Linux and it gets connected to this frequently, right? That's really cool. So that was one really cool thing, is that you could quickly see the identification power of the system. Like within seconds, you know, tags and identification are popping up on all the devices. You could quickly see who the contestants were, you know, the number of people using OS X versus Linux, lots of VMware, lots of Kali. So that stuff was just really cool to see. And then watching the real-time attacks and watching the profiling engine like detect the attacks in real time, that stuff was pretty cool.
So really, I mean, it was just validation for you, I guess, is actually watching the thing work in a real nasty environment.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things too, is like we are used in a number of different environments. We're in factories, we're even embedded in access points. We've deployed in hospitals. So we've seen a lot of different things, but it's very rare to get deployed into an environment that's 100% hostile. Right. And so it was neat to see the profiling engine, how it handled those situations. You know, we didn't expect much and we were surprised. It performed really well.
Now, it's interesting, right? Because I'm, you know, obviously you and I talk a fair bit and, you know, I know quite a bit about your business. And, you know, you've had the market strategy of going out directly to organizations like hospitals who these days, I mean, there's sort of regulatory requirements there for monitoring, you know, embedded medical systems, things like that.
Yep.
What's interesting though is, you know, before we started the interview, you were telling me that when you ran this IoT, you know, hacking village at DEF CON, that you were getting just heaps of interest from MSSPs, which really kind of makes sense because IoT monitoring is fairly straightforward if you've got the right gear.
Yep.
And, you know, this is something that MSSPs can sort of competently manage.
Yep.
You've now launched a program for them.
Yeah, so we came from the services world. So we have like this like kind of researchy, servicey background. So we understand like MSSPs. Like we know, you know, they got to find ways to innovate. We know that they're getting bombarded with questions from scared customers in their portfolio, like hospitals reaching out to them saying, what am I going to do about the IoT problem? I don't even know what's on the network. And so they're hobbling together a lot of solutions, and that's really kind of where our tool can give them immediate value. We plug right into the network. It deploys in like 5 minutes, right? Like even less than that in some cases. Just plug us into the network.
Yeah, just feed it a SPAN port and off you go,
off you go, right? And then it's just dead simple. And it's a SaaS model too. So it's like you log into the web interface. You got this really fancy mobile app if you want to use it. Or you don't even have to use our UI because we export to Splunk, ArcSight, QRadar, like common dashboards, Ceph, JSON, all that stuff. We just, you know, you can consume it in other places. So it's like it just plugs right in. It's tools they already know. The API is awesome. You can make curl requests and get like a list of all the medical devices on the network. Or you can make.
But you're offering like a trial, pretty much, aren't you, for MSSPs, where it's just like, here, give it a go, right?
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
And as you say, because it is a 5 minute install, it's sort of like you're getting good conversions on that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really it's also like our ideal user profile is someone who's going to appreciate the power and the uniqueness of the capability. It's going to leverage things like the API, right? And largely, MSSPs are highly technical people doing highly technical work for people who aren't very technical, right? And trying to be that translation layer and provide some protection. So, you know, we're really a tool that empowers people in that position. So that's, we just kind of realized that like, holy crap, why didn't we do this sooner?
Now, I understand you're, you know, as you mentioned too, Xipitor is the company that you use to deliver training. Listeners would by now have got the impression that you kind of know a fair bit about embedded device security.
Yeah.
You've been doing some Android training. I think that's sold out. You've got some other courses coming up though, right?
Yeah. We wow, you get it all in. Thanks, Patrick. we've been doing trainings for years. Like we were the first like real IoT reverse engineering exploitation course that was available publicly. There actually was one other really good one too, but that one's called Software Exploitation via Hardware Exploitation or Sex via Hex.
Sex via Hex. It's a catchy name. I remember it.
Yep, Sex via Hex. That was actually our second course. Our first one was ARM exploitation, practical ARM exploitation. And this is the third called Android exploitation. I was one of the co-authors on the Android Hackers Handbook. And it really just fits in well with everything, right? The ARM stuff, most you know Android devices are ARM-based. The kind of embedded device space, because Android tends to be used in stuff other than mobile devices. And also the book research too. So just kind of bundling that all up is kind of the round us out in the third training. And we debuted this year at Black Hat. We did a larger course than we normally do, around 40 people, and it sold out. So Sex via Hex sold out again this year for the third or fourth year. And then the new course sold out, which is really cool. So we're doing public versions of those courses too. We're doing one in the EU in Hamburg later this year. And then we have a smaller version in San Francisco and then another one in New York. So
there you go. I will also drop a link to your training stuff as well. It's like Stephen Ridley is here to talk about his bugs, his network monitoring product, and his training. So there you go. It's a triple header.
Yeah. We've been hustling, man. You know, we've been head down, doing a lot of work.
All right, mate. Look, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through all of that. It's all very interesting stuff. And we'll be chatting to you again soon. Stephen Ridley, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
That was Stephen Ridley there of Senryo, and you can find Senryo's website at iot.security. I've dropped links for everything that we spoke about into this week's show notes, so you can find links to training and their MSSP program, trial program. That's all in this week's show notes. Stephen is also offering a discount code for his training to Risky Business listeners. You can get 20% off by using the discount code RISKYBIZ, RISKYBIZ. And of course, you can also get 20% off your rego for the O'Reilly Security Conference by using RISKB as your code. Again, if you do have an IoT monitoring requirement, you really do need to check out Senryo. Stephen demoed it for me when he was in Australia for B-Sides, and it is really cool. It's very slick stuff. And because it's a cloud service, you just plug it into a SPAN port and you are done. And they have a great API as well, so you can get the data into any seam you want if that's your thing. Check them out, iot.security. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.